Okay, good evening. This is the fifth in the series, and tonight we're going to be talking about sexual pleasure. I'll already say that, you know, I'll preempt it by asking your permission to talk about subjects that become rather explicit, because many times I've had students say to me after I give one of these talks, teachers of ours have kind of talked around these things. We think we knew what they were talking about, but you're the first teacher who's actually said exactly what it is all these sources are referring to. And so it may be a little explicit, and that's deliberate, because I don't think euphemisms are helpful in when it comes to sexuality and sexual pleasure. I think sometimes you just need to say it as it is. Tonight, after I finish, I'm going to speak for about 55 minutes, going through this source sheet. Jody has something to put on the barco to show you to talk about sexuality and the, what do you call it? The
sexual response cycle.
And then Natan Alexander is here. He's developed a kosher website for sexual accessories. See, I'm not calling them toys. Not sex toys, sex accessories, which really is an offshoot of what I'm talking about, which is the search for sexual pleasure, which is not as obvious as many people think it's going to be when they begin to have sexual relationships or begin a sexual relationship. And so what I'm going to talk about is what Judaism has to say. I'm going to talk about Jewish sources and some of the tension inherent in the sources. And ultimately, where things are standing today as couples begin to ask the questions they weren't asking 10, 15, 20 years ago. I'll start off by saying that I think in the last 3 to 5 years, there's been an explosion, if you will, of interest in this topic. And almost every week you can open the Post or Haaretz or Makor Rishon and find that there are lecture series going on like this one on sexuality, sexuality in marriage, the sanctity of sexuality, the Kedusha, let's talk about it in Beit Shemesh and in Modi'in and all over Jerusalem, Tel Aviv. I think what's unique about Pardes is it brings together a lot of diverse populations. But in general, this has become a topic, and you know, things gain critical mass. I remember Jody told me when she went to study to be a sex therapist at Bar Ilan, she was in the first cohort, right, of David Ribner's master's, the fifth. But there were very few religious students in the program, and today it's about half, right? Half the students graduating from sex therapy programs are religious, and that again shows kind of the tremendous need for religious people in the conversation, that a secular sex therapist is not necessarily going to understand the needs of their clients, the struggle of clients in terms of expressing sexuality. And so many religious women and men, some men are beginning to go into it. Yahel, Merkaz Yahel. It's an organization, I have to say, I'm not even sure what it stands for, but it's an organization that I became involved with 3 years ago, and it really started because a woman named Michal Prince was doing her master's and then her doctorate on exploring sexual pleasure in the first 5 years of a marital relationship in the national religious population. So she went around interviewing women, young women, to see how, you know, their relationship was evolving, and what she found out is it wasn't. And that a lot of women were stuck, and there was a lot of anxiety and tension and non-pleasure in the marital relationship, despite the fact that the rhetoric in religious conversation is, if you stay celibate until marriage, Gan Eden awaits you. Meaning, wow, the men are told, just control yourselves until marriage. The women are told to be modest and avoid thinking about sexuality. And then you're going to get married. And Judaism endorses marital sexuality. We've talked about it for the last few years. We're going to see the sources, some of them again, this week. But in practice, what she was discovering in her research was that it was a myth that many couples were not happy, and particularly women. And so she opened a kind of a hotline, if that's the right word, where she began both studying the topic more seriously as an educator. She's not a therapist. She is a social worker. And both to educate and to answer questions. And what she described in the course that I took was a flood. Like the phone basically did not stop ringing. She paired up with Rabbi Rafi Ostroff of the Religious Council of Gush Etzion. And what she was finding is that a lot of couples really just needed some basic information. meaning the ones who needed physical therapy, she directed for physical therapy. The ones that needed therapy, she directed to psychotherapist or sex therapist. But she found for many, it was really just getting an understanding, a working understanding of physiology and anatomy and sexuality, and understanding that men and women are not the same, and that there is a different sexual response. It's not as linear for women as it is for men, and many would walk out after a few sessions and things would improve. She found that mostly men were calling, and they were calling for their wives or about their wives. And this inspired her to really start an educational program to educate therapists, but also people like myself, to be more understanding of the complexities of sexuality. And in addition, of course, in our Yoatzot Halacha program, the program I took to study the laws of Nida, of menstruation and intimacy, we spent a lot of time hearing lectures from psychologists, sex therapists, doctors, and so on, with the understanding that in these areas of halacha, it's not exactly like kashrut and Shabbat. You need to have a much deeper understanding of many more subjects beside the halacha, again, on the level of education. I don't think anyone graduated any of these programs, courses, and so on, thinking they could be therapists. But once you're more educated, you already can both validate and affirm and hopefully preempt some of the challenges that come up. Tali Rosenbaum, who is both a physical therapist of the pelvic floor region, and then that led her to becoming a sex therapist, did a study, a very widespread study, of over 300 women, if I'm not mistaken, about the efficacy of sexual pleasure among observant married women. Now, one of the things she says in the introduction is, aside from the books like A Hedge of Roses and Tila Abramov's, I don't remember the anthology, also about the mikvah, something with water. The Waters of Eden, no. Total Immersion was one. There weren't really a lot of books out there talking about reality. There were a lot of books promising, all sorts of rewards if couples hewed to halacha, to tradition, to the hedge of roses that the halachic system imposes on the marital relationship. And what she discovered is when she started studying, she was doing a parallel study to one that had gone on in the States by someone named Loudman. She thought that at the end, observant women would be happier sexually. That's not what she found. She found that the rate of sexual dysfunction and unhappiness paralleled and in some cases was worse than the sexual pleasure in monogamous relationships. Meaning, again, the study was paralleling married women in or monogamous relationships in, you know, the United States. And again, a couple thousand women and some men and a couple hundred men. And she was just studying women, and she did not find that the results were so astonishingly better that you could whip out the halachic system and say, wow, here is the key to marital intimacy and happiness. And so again, from that has come, from that study and from studies, like, you know, conversations like that, have come a lot of reanalysis of sexuality in relationships. And we're going to take a look at the Jewish piece and then take it further. Yes?
I don't know what Hedge of Roses means.
Oh, Hedge of Roses, because you weren't here last week, Celeste. Oh. The Hedge of Roses is a metaphor in the Midrash. Listen to my lecture online, Celeste. Hedge of Roses is the metaphor in Shir HaShirim Rabbah for when a woman tells a man, a woman tells her husband, I have seen a red rose, or red as a rose. He draws back, not because he's been bitten by a snake or a scorpion, not because there's danger, but because of the words of the Torah, which are as soft as the petals of a rose, but nonetheless form a hedge around the couple. It is a metaphor used by Norman Lamb in a book that is really, really old. And if you read it, very, very dated. It's a book that promises marital happiness, that the secret to the Jewish marriage is through the observance of these laws, how unfortunately naive he was. Because when we look around, as I said in my first lecture, there's a lot of unhappiness, dysfunction, abuse, divorce, and so on in our communities, even among those couples who comply completely with the hedge of roses. Okay. And so I think in the last few years, there's really been, if one of the things Tali found was that many women pointed to the poor education they were given before they were married, that really they were not given very comprehensive information about anatomy, physiology, and so on. You know, today I think there's been a lot of work to retrain bride instructors or bride and groom instructors so that at the very least, couples go into marriage regardless of what experience they've had. And even couples who have had sexual experience don't always know how to have a good sexual experience, let alone those who have had no sexual experience. And so as I began to hear more and more lectures, first of all, I'm also a bride teacher, so I teach brides and I try to bring, and I teach the grooms too. I bring a lot of information to the instruction that I give, including diagrams and pictures and so on, and I'm not unique, meaning many of my colleagues do the same thing, you know, because I'm sensitive to the need for understanding and education. And in addition, I often tell the couple, this is not automatic, meaning it may seem when you read the magazines that everyone kind of hops into bed, and certainly when you watch Friends and, you know, I don't know, whatever the shows are, Grey's Anatomy, that everyone's having great sex and it's just like that, and like you just click and it's like, wow, explosive. It takes time to develop a good sexual relationship. In some cases, obviously, it's quicker for some people. If they're more hypersexual, then it can go more quickly. But there are all sorts of challenges along the way, and I think, again, the media has skewed our perception, not just the media, the fact that younger and younger children are having sex, so you're feeling as, well, everyone's doing this and they're doing it right, what's wrong with me? It's not just a religious problem, meaning it's a problem, you know, it's a challenge that non-religious and people having promiscuous sex have as well, how to have good sex, but I'm particularly talking about committed relationships for this evening, committed marital or non-marital, but monogamous relationships. Okay, let's take a look at the mitzvah, the right to sexual pleasure. We have I didn't mention where it is, but it's in Shemot. It's in Exodus 21. If a man sells his daughter, what a lovely thought, to be a maidservant. Sometimes I think my husband would like to do that to some of his four daughters, but okay, we don't do that anymore. She shall not go out as the men's servants do. So already we find out that the Torah protects, we're talking about Ama Ivriya, a Israelite maidservant, not the Canaanite parallel. If she please not her mouth, the translation is very bad. Imra abeine adoneha, asher lo ya'ada vefta, la'am nochri lo yimshal l'machra bevigdo va. He, basically, if a Jewish man, an Israelite man, buys a young girl, and again, we're talking about a young girl under the age of 12. Over the age of 12, a father cannot sell his daughter. All of the rights a father has to his daughter in biblical or halachic Judaism are until the age of 12, 12 and a half. 12 and a half, it ends. She becomes what's called an adult, and he can no longer sell her or even marry her off. Now, if he does not want to marry her, because ultimately a father would do this in order to protect his daughter and hopefully find a marriage partner for her in the house of the master, he may not resell her. And if he wants to sell her to his son, I mean, if he wants to give her to his son, if the master who bought the young girl wants to marry her to his son, he must give her the treatment that all daughters of Israel are entitled to. What are those? Sheirak sutav onata. And that's what we're going to be talking. There are three things women of Israel are entitled to: food, clothing, and sexual relations. And for 3,000 years ago, that's extremely progressive. And I will say for 50 years ago, that's extremely progressive. Not the food and clothing, the sexual relations. Because until recently, it was the right, and certainly in Anglo-Saxon law, and certainly in parts of America, it was the right of a man. Men could rape their wives. There was no such thing as marital rape. And Judaism already in the Torah sets out that a woman has the right to onah, which is understood to be conjugal rights, sexual rights. And throughout the conversation, we're going to come back to that. I cannot underscore how significant that piece is, that the Torah has as an obligation of a husband in marriage to give his wife food, clothing, and sexual relations. Those are the basic tenets of a marital relationship, and there is there's no compromising there. Now, can a couple choose not to have sex? Yes, but we'll talk about that. Yes, no, that, we don't have time.
That's what I was
going to
ask.
Whether they can choose.
Wait,
yes.
Not whether they can choose. Where she has the rights to food, clothing, and sexual relations. What if she doesn't want? Does she
We're going to get to that, to say no. Yes, I'm going to show you that source in a minute. Be patient. If you have questions at the end, ask. If we look at Ketubot chapter 5, a chapter in Mishnah, very important, one of my favorites, and Celeste was in my class last year, and hopefully she remembers it. Hamadirat ishto mitashmish hamita. What if one takes a vow preventing him from, you know, he decides to be very ascetic. He's going through a stage, he wants celibacy, you know, something along the lines of the monks, and he takes a vow not to have sexual relations. How long do we allow the vow to stand? Beit Shammai says 2 weeks, Beit Hillel says 1 week. In other words, if a man can't figure out a way to get out of his vow within 1 or 2 weeks, the court comes in and dissolves the marriage. I mean, they force him to divorce her. In other words, there has to be the potential for sexual relations. If you take a vow of celibacy, and I know it sounds funny because that's what the Christian priests do, the Catholic priests, they take vows of celibacy. Vows in Judaism are serious business. So if you take a vow to be celibate, you can't be married. We don't believe in celibate marriages. Can a couple choose to be celibate? Yes. But you can't take a vow that prevents you from having sexual relations. I mean, you can decide on a day-to-day basis, yes or no. Then we have the laundry list. This is what the Mishnah likes to do. Students may go away to study Torah. How long can they go? They can go for a period of 30 days. If you remember the tractate, the Talmud, the chapter of Ketubot, men go away for 12 and 13 years and very bad things happen. But we're not going to do the stories tonight. Workers have a period of 1 week. The times for conjugal duty prescribed in the Torah are for independent men every day. Well, I mean, independent men, independently wealthy men, men who do not go to work. Rav Moshe Feinstein is going to say something very interesting about why that is. For workers, twice a week. For donkey drivers, once a week. For camel drivers, once in 30 days. For sailors, once in 6 months. These are the words of Rabbi Eliezer. Why is that important? It's important so that if a couple is getting along and everyone's having the sex they want and everyone's happy, then they don't need to pick out this Mishnah and say, oh, maybe we should go to court and argue about this. If a woman is not, or let me start the sentence differently. If a husband does not make himself available to his wife at this minimum, and she is unhappy about this, she can go to the court and demand intervention, and ultimately she can demand a divorce. Meaning, there is a minimum here, just like there is for clothing and food, how much a man is expected to provide. And it depends on the profession. We'll talk about the independently wealthy men and why it's, I think, insightful that their obligation is every day. Idle hands are a devil's work, so to speak. And so we certainly don't want him wandering around town or her wandering around town. Better they meet in the bedroom regularly than get into trouble outside the bedroom because they're not working.
But it's not that it's for men.
No, it's a laundry because it's the men's obligation. We're going to get to women. It's the men's obligation, and this way the woman knows what her rights are. It's always important in the Mishnah to establish categories and legal boundaries. This is a legal boundary for which a woman can sue. If a wife rebels against her husband, this goes to what Donna was asking, and refuses sexual relations, her ketubah is reduced. If a man, what I'm interested in is, okay, that may be obvious. Rabbi Yehuda says 7 tropics, it doesn't matter. If a husband rebels against his wife, an addition of 3 denarii a week. Now, I know it's not equal, but remember, it's not going to be in the Mishnah. But it's a very good parallel that the woman loses a certain amount every week. The man has to add to the ketubah every week half of what she would lose. So again, there's an understanding. If a man is a moreid, it's significant. If a woman is a moreidit and refuses sexual relations, it's significant. Ultimately, the couple needs to have consensual sexual relations. Maimonides' laws of Ishut, she is asked why she rebelled. If she says he is loathsome to me and I cannot willingly have relations with him, then pressure is forthwith exerted on him to divorce her because she is not like a captive that she has to have relations with a man who is hateful to her. However, when she exits the marriage, it's without any. I'm not going to go into that. That's my divorce class that Vanessa's coming to on Thursday. So the point is, though, the Rambam says very clearly, if a woman finds her husband repulsive, specifically in bed, there is no grounds for that marriage continuing. It cannot continue. It's not a sustainable marriage. Women are not like captives. Okay, so again, the Mishnah and Ketubot, the two Mishnahs we saw created a balance. On one hand, there is women know what they are entitled to, when they can go to the court and say, look, he's not providing me with enough sexual relations and I want to sue or I want to fine him or I want a divorce. On the other hand, it's assumed that women also are expected to have sexual relations. Meaning, I said it very nicely. I said it's a woman's right and a man's duty. However, women are also expected at the end of the day. They're expected to consent to sexual relations. Meaning, men aren't going to be allowed to force them. On the other hand, they're going to be expected because that's at the foundation of the relationship. Okay, let's go on. Is it only about procreation? And then we're going to get to make his wife happy. And let me tell you that to make his wife happy is really, really important. And it is the reason why in the Hasidic world, for instance, twice a week, they're expected, when their wives are permitted, they're expected to have sexual relations. And again, you know, not always successfully, but they do. Meaning, we'll see a clip from the Stipler Rebbe. Judaism did not overlook, now this is a quote I brought in the beginning, but it's so amazing that I had to bring it again, Rav Soloveitchik. Judaism did not overlook or underestimate the physical aspects of marriage. On the contrary, once sacrificial withdrawal from the sinful erotic paradise of change and variety is completed, the natural element in marriage comes to the fore. Meaning, once you commit and you leave the meat market and the world of Tinder and the world of junk sex, then essentially the natural element is the erotic element. The two partners owe each other not only fidelity, but also full gratification of their sexual needs. Refusal or failure by one of the partners to satisfy the conjugal rights of the other is sufficient reason for divorce. Each one must observe these laws of consortium with regard to each other. The marriage must not be converted into an exclusively spiritual fellowship. Marriage without carnal enjoyment and erotic love is contrary to human nature and is to be dissolved. So Rav Soloveitchik is saying something very, very strong. He's saying something that other religions do not say. He's saying that sexuality, the erotic relationship between a husband and wife, is not a sustainable relationship. Now, again, does that mean, again, a couple are asexual or a couple are not interested? Or I knew a woman who married a man who was paralyzed from the waist down, so they could not have normative, you know, penetrative sexual relations. Does that mean they couldn't get married? They can get married. But I think what Rav Soloveitchik is trying to do is to do something unusual in a religious dialogue, which is to say sex is really, really important. And yes, it's very physical and it's very carnal and it's erotic and it's all these things that we tend to associate with bad and sinful and anti-spiritual. And yet, it is at the heart of the marital relationship, which we call kiddushin, right? Kiddushin. To make his wife happy, women's pleasure. Babylonian Talmud. Here we're going to get, you know, that myth about the sheet. Now you're going to find out that they knew about kind of the sheet and they ruled against it. So we're going to see. Rabbi Yosef learned. Her flesh, she'era, she'era ksut va'ona, right? So the idea is she'era is the clothes, she'era, Rabbi Yosef is trying to explain here that she'era does not mean food as the pasuk implied. It means close bodily contact. That he must not treat her in the manner of the Persians who perform their conjugal duties in their clothes. This provides support for a ruling of Rav Huna, who said, a husband who said, I will not perform conjugal duties unless she wears her clothes and I mine, must divorce her and give her also her ketubah. There's something very, again, you know, in the Haredi world, when they're taught about sex, and certainly the first night, they're often taught that there have to be no clothes on, that it has to be body to body, flesh to flesh, right? Now, again, I think couples should decide how they want to have sex and what clothing they want to wear. But there's something to that, you know, that the ketubot makes it very clear that there's something demeaning about expecting a woman to wear her clothing or even a man and a woman. That's not the way we do it. The Persians did it that way. That's antithetical to the kedusha, to the sanctity of sexuality.
Is that historically true, that the Persians?
I did not look into it. I did not look into it. Mesechet Kala, what should a man do so that he has rich sons? He should do the desires of heaven and the desires of his wife. Everyone listening? Desires of your wife, Ben? And these are the desires of heaven. He should distribute his money to the poor. These are the desires of his wife. Rabbi Eliezer says he should seduce her at the time of sex. Rabbi Yehuda says he should make her happy at the time of sex with the matter of the mitzvah. As it states, one who keeps the mitzvah will know no bad thing. I think it's, again, the fact that the wife's pleasure ends up being very central to the mitzvah of onah, what's called onah, is again not a small thing. It takes longer for women to come to orgasm, right? On average, 2 to 7 minutes for a man, 12 to 15 minutes for a woman. That's a really big difference, right? Again, I'm shortening the whole linear sexual response cycle, and Jody can pick up on that. But there's no question it takes women longer. And so if a man has to spend more time giving his wife pleasure, the whole thing is going to, you know, be a longer, more intimate experience. I laugh because I have this Cosmo at home that my 16-year-old ended up getting a hold of. She learned a lot of information that I had preferred she wait a little longer to learn. But the reason I kept it in my bathroom was because in addition to having the 50 hottest guys in the centerfold, it had questions that they asked each of these men. These were not movie stars. These are like, you know, Joe Schmo that you meet on the ranch or in the police department across America. And basically they were asked two questions that I'm going to repeat here. It's all in the name, of course, of my research, right? I teach education. They asked two questions. One was, which do you prefer? What's more important to you, your orgasm or hers? And across the board, the men all said hers. And I often tell that to women that I teach them. Women often think, no, well it's for them. Like, you know, men get greater pleasure. And the truth is, it's not a small thing to point out that for many men, giving their partners or their wives pleasure is as important, if not more important, than their own pleasure. The second thing they said, which I laugh at, is, how long does it take you? Oh, an hour to an hour and a half. And I'm like, there is just no way. There is just no way. An hour to an hour and a half. What are they doing, right? So that goes against all the information I've been told about how long it takes men, once they're in a state of desire and arousal, to perform the act, even if they're waiting the 12 to 15 minutes. But I thought it was funny that they all had these, like, very long, you know, oh, yes, hours. Which suggests that people don't always tell the truth when you ask them questions. We're not really going to say 15 minutes, an hour. Okay, Nita 25b. Rabbi Yitzchak, the son of Ami, said, if a woman seeds, if she orgasms first, she will bear a male child. If a man orgasms first, she will bear a female child. Again, I cannot underemphasize how significant that text is. What an incentive, right? You know, 2,000 years ago, men, the patriarchal society, having a firstborn son and so on. There's a promise to men who manage to bring their wives to orgasm first to have a boy. And what better incentive is there than that? And so that continues to reverberate in the Middle Ages. You'll see, I don't know if I brought all the sources, but almost everyone mentions in the medievalists that, oh, remember that source in Nita 25b? You know, if the woman has pleasure first, you get a male child. And so I think, again, as an incentive, not a small thing. I don't know if there was any scientific proof of that. But it's nonetheless, I think, an important statement, again, emphasizing the power of the woman's sexual pleasure, this centrality. Sefer HaMitzvot HaKatan, Rabbi Yitzchak of Corbeil, France, 13th century. The mitzvah for a man to make his wife happy or give pleasure to his wife, as it states, and he shall make happy the wife he has taken. There is connected to this positive commandment a negative prohibition, namely, he shall not diminish her onah. Now, how great is this mitzvah? For behold, the Torah exempted him from going to the army for its sake. And even if his wife is pregnant, it is a mitzvah to make her happy if he understands that she is desirous of this and he has the health to do it. The idea is throughout one's marriage. It is not just about procreation. Regular sexual relations are mandated regardless of whether there is pregnancy or the potential for pregnancy. When the woman is pregnant, when the woman is menopausal, if the woman is what's called an akara, she is infertile, she doesn't have a uterus, that does not preclude sexual relations. There are two mitzvot here, procreation and sexual relations. They are two distinctly separate. Of course, they come together to make the baby, right? You do need to do one to get, although today not as much, but you do need to do one to have the other. They understood that, but they also separated out the centrality of the mitzvah regardless of procreative possibilities. Igrot HaKodesh. We said that it was attributed to the Ramban. In fact, in Hebrew, it says the Ramban. That's incorrect. It was not the Ramban. It was another medievalist living at around the same time as the Ramban. Every time that a man connects through intercourse to a woman, it should not be with lightheadedness and words of vanity and illusions. And do not behave frivolously with your wife, and do not have excessive trivial conversations with her. Therefore, you put her into mood first with words that pull her heart and settle her mind and make her happy, so that you tie her mind with your mind and her intention with your intention. Tell her things, some of which put her in the mood with words of lust, love, and desire, and some of which will pull her to fear heaven, righteousness, and modesty. And when you connect through intercourse with her, do not be quick to arouse desire in her, so that her mind is settled, and enter with her through words of love and desire, in order that she should give seed first, that her seed should be like the matter, and your seed should be the form, as with this matter it states, a woman who gives seed and gives birth to a male. They thought, the Ramban talked about, although this isn't the Ramban, they thought women did have seed. They didn't know about the egg, but they thought women had some sort of procreative, not power, that's the wrong word. They thought that when a woman orgasmed, she also seminated, but they didn't quite understand how that worked. So they understood that, it was possible that a woman had seed that gave forth a male child. The Ravad and the Baalei HaNefesh. So now we've actually gone back a couple hundred years. We can also say that the times that the sages gave for intercourse, they established them for the standard case because they assessed the woman's mindset, that she should be appeased by her husband and so on. But if he sees that she is asking to have sex, and I see the woman who was here last week and asked me about a woman asking for sex, I'll mention that in a minute, and that she needs it, which he sees through her enticing him and making herself beautiful to him, then he is obligated to make her happy with the matter of the mitzvah, as our sages have said. And last week someone had asked me that in her Hadrachat Kalot class many years ago, she was told that a woman should never ask for sex. She should never verbally ask for sex. And I'm not saying that that isn't anywhere in the sources, but first of all, I don't think all the sources agree, and certainly the Ravad is saying if she's asking to have sex and he sees that she needs it, meaning she's asking and or he sees that she is dressing a certain way, she's flirting with him, she's making little comments, then certainly he should be obliged. And I think, again, a lot of times it's not a matter of, well, honey, you're home now, let's go have sex. I mean, a lot of times it's more subtle than that. And I think when instruction is given, don't do this or do that, it often suffocates the moment, meaning people have to be comfortable to entice or suggest or seduce in any way that they can. And I think the Ravad understands that men need to be mindful. Because again, when men feel desire that leads to arousal, for them perhaps it's a more direct means of communication from their brain down to their body. But women, sometimes it's more subtle and being aware. And there isn't, again, a lot of magazines will say how to get your man to know when you're in the mood, right? That's always that, because there is an understanding that for women, sometimes it is a little uncomfortable to say, oh, I'm in the mood. How are they going to hint and so on? And I'm not advocating one way or the other. I'm just saying that the Ravad is putting the burden on the husband to be aware of his wife's sexual desire. Igrot Moshe, here I'm going to go through this very quickly, but the Igrot Moshe is going to talk about the men of leisure. So now we're going back to the men of leisure. Go down to the middle of the second paragraph. And with men of leisure, who have the strength and time every day, perhaps they assess that women, knowing this, that he has strength and time, will be desirous every day. But this seems not to make sense that she would be desirous every day. Rather, it is for a different reason, that she will think that if he really loved her, he definitely would want to be having sex with her daily, because she knows that a man has even more desire, even more than a woman, as is explained in Ketubot 64. Thus, she will think that it is because he does not love her, that he does not want to have sex with her daily, and she will have great anguish over this, perhaps more than the actual absence of sex. Thus, the rabbis obligated him every day, although it is not very common that a woman would have desire to have sex every day. Rav Moshe says something very interesting. He tries to understand why the man of leisure, the independently wealthy man, the man who doesn't go to work, has the obligation, or he's obligated, he has a duty to provide his wife with sexual relations. And Rav Moshe said it's not because the woman is hypersexual. It's because the woman's going to look at him and think, but men want, he should be wanting to have sex. If he loves me and he has nothing else to do, then why isn't he desiring me? Which I think, again, is somewhat insightful. Sometimes, well, aren't I pretty enough? Doesn't he love me enough? If he loved me, then he'd want to have sex with me, right? There's something counterintuitive almost there. And that's how Rav Moshe is explaining the idea that men who are wealthy have a greater duty, if you will, because they don't have anything else to do. And so then the women will start feeling insecure that he must not love me enough, or maybe he has someone on the side, because otherwise he'd be using that energy that he'd be using in work for something else. A letter from the Stipler. This is an unpublished letter that circulated. Now, of course, nothing is private, so it is now circulating on the internet. Rabbi Dov Linzer translated it. It's from 1974. I just excerpted part of it. The obligation. All forms of contact, touch and kissing are included. The Chazon Ish allows a man to have sexual thoughts for his wife when she is not in need of. Now, again, this is for the Hasidic community. So I'm not pretending this is like Cosmo 2015, but this is nonetheless for the Hasidic community important. Thus, he should lie with his wife together naked with touching and kissing for approximately a quarter of an hour before intercourse. This is under normal circumstances. But if he is already sexually excited and concerned, he will ejaculate prematurely. God forbid, then he should speed up. We'll talk about that, because this was 1974, and I'm not sure in 2015 he'd be saying the same thing. Again, the fear that a man will, God forbid, waste seed and ejaculate prematurely is very concerning. And after intercourse, he should lie with his wife for a half an hour, because this will give her greater pleasure than the act itself. And then he talks about, I'm not going to go into that. He talks again about the fact of, spending time touching and kissing. Otherwise, you're like a lion who tramples his prey and eats it. One who grabs his wife and has sex immediately without prior physical intimacy and then separates immediately. It's a terrible thing. He's going to make her cry. She's not going to have pleasure. She's going to be in pain and embarrassed. He talks about the gates of tears are never locked. And then, wait, I want to go to the three dots, because we're going to see the Shulchan Aruch. And what is stated in the Shulchan Aruch, to have sex in a state of trembling, to have body parts largely covered, to do it quickly, all of this can only be considered after the woman is appeased and desirous of this. In other words, if he manages to bring his wife to seed, right, so she has pleasure, and then afterwards he's left, well, if he wants to behave that way, like a demon, we're going to see that source about the demon, then he can do so. Because lacking that, it is forbidden to have sex with her without her agreement. And then basically he says, I don't really understand where the Shulchan Aruch gets that. He writes towards the end, he quotes the Ari, the correct ruling is in accordance with the first explanation, his intention not be for pleasure before the... hold on one second. This is not the law, he says, about being largely clothed and having sex quickly. This would be forbidden according to the Kabbalah, regardless, even according to the Shulchan Aruch, only with the full agreement of his wife. And with this in mind, when one attempts to make his wife happy at the time of sex before it and after it, this is not unseemly, God forbid, but rather a mitzvah. Again, so over and over again, we're saying, do not feel that you have to kind of jump into bed, get the mitzvah done really quickly, don't enjoy it too much, don't uncover anything, don't touch, don't talk. No, you're supposed to take your time. It's important. Rav Eliashiv Knoll, I'm going to finish this section with
one. Do you think that, in this sense, the Hasidic men actually ask their wives for approval of things? You could do it quickly if your wife approves. Do you really think that
so I'm going to take a moment to answer. So I'm going to answer that question with, again, I've heard from both Dr. David Ribner and Dr. Batsheva Marcus, both of whom are sex therapists to the Hasidic community. Okay, so I'm hearing case studies from there. A lot of couples are coming and presenting their sexual dysfunction, and largely, I remember David saying this very clearly. The women are basically coming and saying, look, we want to have sexual pleasure. We want to know how to do it. Tell us how. And he said the men are terrified. That was his quote. Despite the stipler, despite everything we're reading, right? So he said even like among the Gerur Hasidim, which are among the most ascetic of the Hasidim, the Satmar, more and more couples are basically coming to people like him and like Batsheva Marcus. And the rabbis are largely on board in helping, again, in those communities, it's really only going to go through the rabbis. And Batsheva, there's an article in the New York Times you can find, if you Google Batsheva Marcus, it's quite explicit, where she talks about, you know, conversation, you know, how much of the woman's body the man can see or touch or, you know, whatever he can do to kind of bring her to pleasure. And, you know, two out of the three things the rabbi said no, but the third thing, to her surprise, he said yes. That because we're not Hasidim here, I don't think we, if anyone is, feel free to come over to me afterwards. I'll refer to you to a good therapist. But Hasidim, I think, are unique in that everything's going to go through the rabbi. And the concern of, but nonetheless, even there, there is a tremendous interest and desire for sexual pleasure. And I will say porn addiction is not a small problem they're having in that community. And I think that's why so many people are kind of getting on board. That's why there are more therapists there and the rabbis are becoming more educated. What? Well, but he's not in the Hasidim aren't going to know about Shmuley Boteach. Okay. For some women, the act of Rav Knoll, I'll just again, this is a somewhat explicit text, but he talks about the importance of female orgasm. For some women, the act, and this touches on female masturbation, which we talked about a few weeks ago, the act of intercourse itself provides sufficient stimulation in order to climax. In most cases, orgasm is achieved through the gentle stimulation of the vagina. While masturbation is forbidden to men because it involves wasting seed, a woman has no such limitation, and there is no problem with a husband bringing his wife to orgasm in this way. Most men ejaculate almost every time, where a woman may experience sexual pleasure without orgasm. Nevertheless, she should not miss out on this experience, which is so fundamental to their life as a couple, and they should make an effort to achieve it often, if not always. And
can I just add something?
Yeah.
Because there's a little bit of a, when he says for some women, I think it's important to remember that it's to notice that he's saying for some women. For some women, the act of intercourse itself provides sufficient stimulation in order to climax. That's talking about between 10 to 20% of the women. Between 70 to 80% of women need manual stimulation, mm-hmm. and they will not come to climax from
intercourse.
From
intercourse.
Relations.
Right.
And that's a very, very important thing to
Yeah. And then he talks about on page 34 in his little, there's like a booklet that comes with his book. It's not in the book. You have to buy it separately or get it separately. A couple may also experience the opposite problem during the early days of marriage. The husband may experience early ejaculation. This is a common phenomena, and the man should not be concerned that he is violating the prohibition against wasting seed. Rather, he should view it as part of the learning how to perform the mitzvah. Most men often encounter initial difficulties. This is quite natural. I will say that I'm going to take this paragraph and expand on it for a minute. I remember when I was at Matan 12 years ago, I was translating responsa for Eretz Chemda, which is a place in which a lot of questions come in. And one of the questions that came in that now if I look back, I think it kind of traumatized me, was a woman who was menopausal who cannot have vaginal sex, meaning it was impossible. It was very painful. There was no other option. That was not an option. And he wrote in saying, is there something else we can do so that I can nonetheless, we can have the intimacy and I can have some sort of release. And the answer he was given was no. Now, this was 10, 12 years ago. The husband, he wanted to know if he could ejaculate without penetration. Okay, because again, that was not going to be possible and he couldn't force his wife and it was painful and so on and so forth. And the answer at the time was no, and I don't believe that would be the answer today. And I don't think that would be the answer. And we're going to see that we have a Ramah. Even then, I'm not sure why it was the answer. We're going to get to what is permitted in the last section. Is coercion ever allowed? The short answer is no, of course not. Coercion is not allowed. Coercion is not allowed, not anger and not drunkenness and not when asleep. There has to be a mindfulness that this is what you're doing and this is the act that you're engaged in. I'm gonna skip for lack of time the next two pages, the section on coercion, but I'll just say again, the Talmud is very aware about the imbalance, that at the end of the day, men are the more aggressive. Women can be raped. When I was teaching Daf Yomi last year, we got to the page, they consider, can a man be raped? That question comes up in the Talmud. Because you want to know, can a man be forced to have sexual relations? And then it was in the context of Yibum, levirate marriage. And they come up with a very funny scenario. Those who have learned Yibum know what I'm talking about, which I was teaching on a day that a mother was coming to check out Torah Vavodah. And I ended up teaching something really, really boring. And my students are like, wait, where's that piece you promised us? When she left, I taught it to them. It had to do with the fact that if a man is aroused on the roof of a building and he falls off the roof and he manages to penetrate a woman who is against, there's a goat that appears in the sugya also, but I'll spare you the goat. But a woman, then that's a case where, again, essentially, she's lying there waiting, meaning she's ready for this. I don't know, timing-wise, how that would work, but she's ready for this, and so essentially, then that would be a man who's had a coercive sexual. It's theoretical. It's very Talmudic. Like, what is the most theoretical possibility we could have where a man could be coerced? The point is that in these sources, there is an understanding that a man has more strength and he has more power, and if he's angry or if he's drunk, he may take advantage and rape his wife, and that is not acceptable and not allowed in Jewish law or in Jewish text. And over again, that is emphasized. Again, I just brought you a smattering of it. It appears in all of the halachic codes, in the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, the Torah, the Shulchan Aruch, and all sorts of retribution, meaning if you have sex with your wife and it leads to pregnancy, then your children are going to be a product of that, and there's going to be a price you're going to pay for having that. Again, the Ran talks about children of fear. He places his fear upon his wife, children of force, children of hatred, children of the ban, children of exchange, and so on and so on, children of strife. He goes into each of these. It's a interpretation of the Tractate of Nedarim. But it goes on from there over and over, and that ultimately there needs to be mindfulness, meaning what we keep coming back to in Jewish tradition is that what makes sex sanctified is the understanding that that two people, a man and a woman, are coming together for dveikut, to be close to one. And yes, there can be lots of fun and lots of pleasure, but ultimately you can't lose sight of the fact that there are feelings of love. And one of the things I talked about earlier is, every time I talk, I can't go back to every piece I said, is I think in non-marital relationships or in LGBT relationships as well, these values and ethics can also very much find a place in that sex, in order for it to be sanctified, in order to have a place in Jewish tradition, has to have something to it. It has to have feelings of love, essentially, feelings of caring, feelings of intimacy. Okay, the Shulchan Aruch, one of the things I just wanted to point out, bottom of page 6, if he was angry with her, he cannot have intercourse with her until he appeases her. He may speak, flirt with her before intercourse to please her. So yes, makeup sex is okay, but sex during a fight, no, not okay. You have to at least be flirting, joking, already in some sort of stage of making up before engaging. Are there limits? And this is where I'm going to start. Why? I mean, the last two pages are the questions that many people have. What are the limits? And then I'll share two conversations I've had with rabbinic authorities on this topic. The Babylonian Talmud in Nedarim, which I brought all the way back in the first lecture. We have tension there because we have Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai saying, the ministering angels told me four things. People are born lame because their parents overturned the table. It's called Hafichat HaShulchan. The question there is, when you overturn the table, are we talking about anal sex or are we talking about women on top? They have another phrase for anal sex, which is bia shelo kedarka, penetrative sex, not the normal way. Dumb because they kiss that place. That's the woman's genitalia, the vagina. Deaf because they converse during cohabitation. Blind because they look at that place. Ima Shalom was asked, why are your children so exceedingly beautiful? She replied, I'm bringing this because this is the source that's rejected. That's what I said. This expresses the tension there is over sexuality and sexual pleasure. It's more what we associate with Christianity than we do with Judaism. And yet, shadows of it are going to reverberate throughout the next 2,000 years. We are not going to be able to ignore completely Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai and Ima Shalom, even though they're rejected. You're going to see. Why are your children so exceedingly beautiful? Because my husband converses with me neither at the beginning nor at the end of the night, only at midnight when he converses, when he talks to me. He uncovers a hand breath and covers a hand breath, and as though he were compelled by a demon. And when I asked him, what is the reason for this? He replied, so that I may not think of another woman, lest my children be as bastards. Of course, they won't be bastards because he's entitled, unless it's a married woman. But again, you get the point. Rabbi Yochanan said, the above is the view of Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai, but our sages said the halacha is not as Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai. A man may do whatever he pleases with his wife. And as I said then, you must read this together with everything we just skimmed through in the previous section, not non-consensually. Okay, yes, a man may do whatever he pleases with his wife as long as she agrees to it, right? There's no non-consensual sex in Jewish halacha or tradition. If we take a look at Maimonides, and again, here a woman once came before Rebbe. She said, Rebbe, I set a table for my husband. He overturned it. Again, is that an indication of anal sex or the woman being on top? There's a machloket in the Rishonim. It seemed to me, even Art Scroll agreed in the footnote that it was possibly talking about anal, but you know, that throughout the centuries, there's sometimes a step forward and a step back. Isurei bia, a man's wife is permitted to him. Therefore, whatever a man wishes to do with his wife, he may do. That's like Rebbe Yochanan. He may have intercourse whatever he pleases. He may kiss any organ he wishes. And he may have intercourse in a natural or unnatural, that's the bia shekadarka, shelo kadarka, vaginal or anal, as long as he does not expend semen to no purpose. And nevertheless, the pious way is not to act lightly in this matter and to sanctify himself, kadesha tatzmecha, during intercourse. Okay, so that tension between a man can do whatever he wants, or a couple can do, let me use more modern parlance, a couple may do whatever they want to achieve pleasure. The question is, then, what does it mean he may not expend semen? We're going to see what the Rama does. But then the Rambam says at the end, well, kadesh atzmacha, meaning maybe be a little more moderate, or a lot more moderate in the bedroom. Let's take a look at the Shulchan Aruch.
With the last one,
and he ought to deviate from the common practice, for this thing is really only for procreation. Yeah, he needed to throw that in. He doesn't really, I would suggest, he that's not consistent with the rest of the way he talks about sexuality, but the Rambam was a bit of an ascetic when it came to, it seems to me, from sexual practice.
Is he really saying ideally if procreation, but whatever you need to do?
Yes, because that tension of procreation versus sexual pleasure, the idea that sex is really super physical and erotic and carnal, and it's all about the body and the pleasure of the body, and it feels like it should be a little sinful because it feels so good sometimes or so bad sometimes, I think very much reverberates throughout the text. But once the Talmud established that from the Torah there's an obligation to give your wife sex and then sexual pleasure, you can't really undo it, but you can express your tension over it, right? So you see that. If we take a look at the Shulchan Aruch really has a lot of conflict. Everyone is, basically, he takes the position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai and Rabbi Eliezer. He talks about, again, If it's for your wife, it's all good. Everyone is obligated to be intimate with his wife on the nights when she immerses and when he leaves on a journey, if he is not traveling for a mitzvah purpose. Likewise, if one's wife is nursing and he notices that she is coaxing him and enticing him and adorning herself in his presence so that he will give her his attention, he is obliged to be intimate with her, which again is very nice because often women, when they're nursing, have a lot of extra hormones and can be sometimes even more sexual than usual. So I don't know if he noticed that or it was just, you know, something he picked up. Even when one is with his wife, he should not have his enjoyment in mind. And here we have the tension. Instead, he should have the attitude of a person who is discharging the obligation that he owes to his wife of having relations with her and the times required of him by the Torah and so on. I'll just say the Shulchan Aruch had 4 or 5 wives. Okay, he was never, not simultaneously, but he was never without a wife. It was not that he himself led a celibate life. He was a man who had a lot of conflict over sexuality. It becomes clear in a treatise he wrote called, someone remember the Shulchan Aruch, where he has a dialogue with an angel. He has a lot of conflict over sexuality, but he himself was always married, and he lived until his 80s. But on the other end, you see his conflict, meaning basically he's saying he should not have his enjoyment in mind. He should have the attitude of a person who's discharging the obligation. For the wife, it's okay to enjoy. For the husband, not so much. Let's see what that Ramah says. And the Ramah is very important, and then I'm going to finish with the Ramah and a conversation I had based on this. And a man can do with his wife as he pleases, have sexual intercourse any time that he desires, kiss any organ that he desires, and have natural or unnatural intercourse or between the legs, as long as he does not waste semen. He's quoting the Torah. And there are those who are lenient and say unnatural intercourse is allowed, even if he emits semen, if it is done randomly, and he is not accustomed to this. And even though all of this is permitted, all who sanctify themselves, again, kadesh et atzmo, with what is permitted to them, sanctified, they will say to him. So one of the conversations I had with a rabbi I talked to about these things a lot, I've spoken to other rabbis as well, is what about the Ramah? Why do we forget the Ramah? Meaning when people go and basically say, we can't have vaginal sex, can we do anything else? How come no one remembers the Ramah who basically says, yes, you can. You shouldn't do it all the time. It shouldn't be the only way you have sexual relations. Clearly, the face-to-face model where you see one another, vaginal intercourse, that is considered the preferred method of intercourse. But nonetheless, the Ramah, based on the Rambam, based on the Talmud, opens up a very big door for other forms of sexual engagement, including the ejaculation of a man outside of the woman's body. And I think I know a lot of couples struggle with that restriction. Because often women who are, you know, not ready will feel they have to be a vessel. And then the man feels he has to, you know, be, you know, perhaps more, not the word is coercive, assertive or aggressive because of the fear that he will waste seed. And it causes a lot of tension. So the two things I've got, I'll just share, you know, some of the answers I've gotten. One is that over and over, I think the concern, and not unrightfully, although it seems a little patriarchal when it comes from men rabbis who are talking, is the concern that men will ask their wives to do things that their wives may not be comfortable for doing. And then the question is it for the purpose of the couple's mutual sexual pleasure, or is there an element of self-pleasure involved? And initially, again, my response to both times I heard that response, well, you know, does a woman really want to have sex that way? I'm a feminist. What do you mean? How can you ask that question? Women can do anything. But after I kind of calmed down and thought about it, I was like, I understand a little bit of what they're saying, which is sometimes people want to act out things they may have seen or heard or lo aleinu, hopefully not porn, but unfortunately many people do watch porn. The question is that good for the couple's intimacy? Does that what sexuality is meant to do, which is bring them together? So I even say to couples, there are no real restrictions. There aren't. I mean, we have the Ramah, we have the Rambam, we have the Talmud. On the other hand, I think there has to be not just consensuality, consideration and respect and understanding of what this act is going, what I'm really asking my wife to do or my husband to do or my partner to do, however you want to phrase it, and whether it's really only for me or whether it's really about the two of us and creating something that is about the two of us. So I think that the Shulchan Aruch and the whole idea of the fear of a man, you know, wasting seed and restricting sexual relations to vaginal sex has been very detrimental. I've heard sex therapists over and over talking about it, that really when you restrict it to that, it causes a lot of tension in the bedroom. And we really need to step away from that. And as I said, I've already talked to several rabbis who are like, well, if it's really, you know, because the woman is it's initiative of the woman. It's not what she wants. She doesn't want to have vaginal sex. She wants to have other forms of sex. Then definitely it should be considered by the couple. But what I'm hearing from the men is not, again, something that I think needs to be listened to also, that ultimately the question is, you know, when you wake up in the morning and make breakfast together, you know, are you going to be able to look each other in the eye? And if you say yes once, does that mean you have to say yes again? Meaning the boundaries I talked about when I talk about non-marital sex, I think are similar for marital sex or committed sex, that ultimately I think people have to also think about what it is they're asking someone to do and whether it's going to be good for the relationship, for the other person, as well as for themselves. And so, if, you know, I would say that sexual relations or the sexuality in a relationship ebbs and flows. The question is, where are you going to get the excitement, the desire? How are you going to continue to be attracted? You know, we talked last week about Nida, the perpetual honeymoon, and that's not really for all couples the way to foster desire, although for some couples it is. That ultimately, I think, you know, Judaism not just encourages, but demands that we continue to create dveikut and kedusha through the act of sexual relations. And I think today there are different challenges. And I think, again, Jody and Natan will talk about some of that more from the field.